Welcome to East Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. Well, Chapel Hill's William Dunstan is a respected historian, teacher, now visiting scholar at UNC Chapel Hill. My friend Lloyd Kramer, history professor, and I are going to talk with William Dunstan about his three books of ancient history, his growing up years in Elizabeth City that he covers in his multi-volume memoir called Adventures of Southern Boyhood. And we're going to talk, I think, also about how these personal histories that he writes about and the what Dr. Kramer calls collective histories, the scholarly histories, how they intersect, if at all. And so, first of all, Lloyd Kramer, thanks for coming and being my co-host today.
Thank you, D.G. I'm happy to be part of this conversation.
And William Dunstan, thanks for coming and sharing with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a singular honor for me to be here with you two distinguished gentlemen.
Well, it's an honor for us, too, and it's an exciting one. Lloyd, you suggested that there might be an intersection between personal history and the history of a scholarly history or scholarly of ancient times. What were you getting at?
Well, I'm very interested in what William has done with his memoir because I think he's been writing a story about his family and his own boyhood in eastern North Carolina. But throughout this memoir, he connects the events of his own family's experiences from the time of the Civil War, even before the Civil War, through the First World War, the Second World War, the Great Depression. And I think his memoirs show how our lives as individuals and as families always intersect with public events, even when we are simply concerned with our own private affairs. And that's what I find interesting. And I'm glad we can talk with William about why he wrote this book and what he's trying to do.
Well, I tell you what, let me jump ship for just a minute and talk to us. I want to talk just for a minute and maybe longer later on, but three big volumes of ancient history. And you're an individual scholar without the support of hundreds of graduate students to do your research. Or how do you discipline yourself to do this? And why do you want to do it?
Well, it all began in 1988. In 1988, I was director of the College Transfer Program, later called the University Transfer Program at Durham Technical Community College in Durham. And as the director of the program, I had to authorize all textbooks. The reason being, we had to make certain that anything that we did at Durham Tech would transfer. Any course we taught would transfer. I had visited every university in the Triangle, and I had gone as far as Western and as far as East Carolina. I had gone to Duke. I went everywhere, small colleges, large universities. I wanted to find out what they wanted from us because I was the founding director. So I hired the faculty, set up the classrooms, everything. It was quite a chore. Well, it was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And one day, when I was sitting in my office, a textbook representative from Prentice Hall came to talk with me. And she said, "We would like for you to look at our books to see if you would authorize them." And she said, "Unfortunately," she said, "we don't have anything in ancient history at the moment." So I said, "Oh, well, let me write them."
Oh, come on now.
What I said. I said, "Let me write them." And I was kidding, of course. The next day, I got a telephone call from acquisitions editor. I believe he was in New Jersey. And he said, "Let me fly down and talk to you about these books because we really need them." So he flew in. He came to my office. He talked about ancient history books. I told him, I said, I was trained in Tudor Stuart, England. And I was not trained in ancient history. I've never had a course in ancient history, but I think I can do this. So he said, "Well, try." He said, "Send us three chapters. We'll send them for review. If the reviews prove favorable, then you will get a contract." So I thought, I cannot be here at Durham Tech and do this project because it's going to be a mammoth project. So what I did is I resigned from Durham Tech every student at Durham Tech signed a petition not to accept my resignation, but at any rate. And I got a job teaching as an adjunct at NC State. So I could write halftime, teach halftime. When I got to NC State, much to my amazement, there was some scorn about the idea of a person trained in Tudor Stuart England diving into ancient history. And I realized maybe I made a big mistake, but I'm not the kind of person to turn around from something I've accepted. And so I plunged in, and it took me from 1988 until 2010 to finish those three books.
Was the publisher still waiting for you at that time?
Well, the first publisher was Prentice Hall. Now, let me tell you what happened with Prentice Hall. I sent the three chapters into Prentice Hall, and the acquisitions editor wrote back, and he said, "These chapters are entirely too scholarly for today's students. We cannot offer you a contract. Sorry, goodbye." In the meantime, the acquisition editor of Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, brand new acquisitions editor, no experience, had heard somehow that I was writing these books. He calls me on the telephone. He says, "We hear that you're writing some books in ancient history. Would you give us a chance to publish them?" I said, "Well, yes, I'll be glad to consider that." So he comes down. We meet. I've got the chapters ready for him. He looks them over. He sends them for review. Their reviews are good. And so I've got my contract. But by the time I finish the first book, Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston no longer exist. It's been gobbled up by Harcourt Brace. Now, the same acquisition editor has moved over to Harcourt Brace, so I can still work with him. The first book comes out with Harcourt Brace, second one with Harcourt Brace. By the time the third one comes out, Harcourt Brace has been gobbled up by Wadsworth. So it's published by Wadsworth. Mm-hmm. And so I've gone through many, many editors and many experiences with the publishers. But at any rate, when I finished the Ancient Roman book, in the meantime, since 1988, when people heard that I was writing, everyone in my hometown was asking me to write stories about my boyhood.
Let me just start. Can I?
Yes.
Excuse me, William. I really, I want to, both Lloyd and I want to get into the boyhood stories.
Yeah.
But Lloyd, I'm floored by this story. I mean, you've got colleagues, and you've, in fact, done a textbook on European history. And so you you're the only two guys I know who got this textbook stuff. Yeah, but that's an extraordinary story, isn't it?
Well, I think it shows, first of all, how the textbook industry is always in turmoil, and the people you start with are rarely there when you finish. But also what I find interesting is how there is an interest in finding ways to reach students with non-scholarly accounts of history, and how many professional historians are reticent about doing that, but there is a demand for it, and people like William have taken that challenge. So I think it's great that he did.
Well, it's interesting that William said his colleagues at North Carolina State in history department were sort of, what are you doing taking on an assignment way out of your field? One of the things that and you're colleagues would probably have the same attitude about it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, where you're really of great service as a historian and a skilled one is in sharing this with non-scholars, is sharing the story, inspiring people who are not scholars to get interested in history.
I think that may be one of the advantages of writing about subjects maybe you don't know as much about. You have the same questions that a naive reader might have. What happened? Why did it happen? What does it mean? In a way that an expert may be so close to the subject, they have a harder time producing a narrative that will reach a general audience. And I think William knows how to do that.
Both of you, I've got... excuse me to our listeners who would probably rather hear William talk some about your question about growing up in Elizabeth City, but I'm interested as a crass layman about the economics of this. Both of you have published textbooks, and you've published other scholarly books. I was looking at William at the cost of William's books, and they're $100 and up per volume. So can you make some money writing textbooks?
William, this is a very difficult question to answer. Yes, I mean, I would say more than you can make for writing an obscure scholarly book on a subject that not very many people are interested in.
It depends on the field, of course. If I had written one volume in ancient history, I would be making probably far more money. I make around $3,000 a year from the three books.
Just continued.
Remember, the first one's the ancient Near East. There's not a huge market for that. The second one is ancient Greece, and the third one is ancient Rome. So I make about $3,000 a year, sometimes four, from the royalties. The publishers, they promote the books. Now, what is different about my books, I think, is as Lloyd mentioned, is I ask questions in a different way because I wasn't familiar with the field. And so I wanted to know more about what did people eat, how did they dress, what were their customs, what did they do for recreation, how did they react to war, what were their religious beliefs, and that sort of thing. Because I had all these questions myself. That's why it took me so long to write them, because I had to research the questions to find out what was taking place in society. But back to your earlier question about the boyhood books, when I started writing the history books or the ancient history books, people in my hometown would say, wait a minute, why are you wasting your time with this when you have these fascinating stories from your boyhood?
Wow.
And they would mention things. For example, Gwen Evans, one of my best friends, Gwen Evans Forbes, I saw her about 10 years ago with her husband, Sam Forbes. And she said to me, she said, you know, she said, I just hope I live long enough to see you write the story of bringing the fish back to life in the eighth grade.
Now, I tell you what, William, we're going to take a break and then come back and talk about these Elizabeth City stories. I'm visiting with my co-host, Professor Lloyd Kramer, and we're visiting with William Dunstan about his writing. And when we come back, we're going to talk about growing up in Elizabeth City. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is William Dunstan, and my co-host is Lloyd Kramer. Lloyd, you'd ask William to talk a little bit about, if you joined us late, we've been talking about his books on ancient history, and we're moving into how that led to writing about growing up in Elizabeth City. So tell us more about your pressure from your hometown folks to write about. You're growing up in Elizabeth City.
Well, apparently people thought that my life was eccentric, that I was always stumbling in some kind of shenanigan or doing something really unusual. So, for example, I did a play in the eighth grade that was broadcast to my home room about Neil Cropsey. And I did a huge amount of research on that and found out exactly, well, not exactly what happened to her, but who did not kill her.
Was that event?
It was not Jim Wilcox, who was accused and was sent to prison for killing Nell Cropsey.
I'm going to interrupt you, and I apologize for doing it, but Nell Cropsey's not a household name in Chapel Hill, except that our buddy, Bland Simpson, has written what he calls it's sort of a combination between novel and or a novel based pretty largely on history, and so those of us who read that book got to know about Nell and about Jim Wilcox and about that. But not so you mentioned it now. You're going to have to tell a little bit of that story.
Well, let me just tell you a little about the story. The story takes place in the year 1901. Nell Cropsey has moved with her father in 1898 from Brooklyn, New York, with her large family. They live on Riverside Avenue in Elizabeth City. She immediately attracts as a suitor a young man named Jim Wilcox. This is 1898 when they arrive. Now, Jim Wilcox has grown up as a privileged young man because his father was a sheriff of Pasquotank County, Republican sheriff of Pasquotank County. But with the Democrat sweep in 1898 based on white supremacy, and so the Republicans were swept out of office, the Democrats were swept in, and Sheriff Wilcox is now a private citizen, and Jim is no longer a privileged young man. Well, at any rate, he and Nell date for 3.5 years. Now, she is very high strung. She disappoints him in many ways. She flirts with other men. She is rumored to have a secret lover, perhaps a married man. All kinds of rumors surrounding this young couple. And then, to make matters worse, in the fall of 1901, she begins to go to a series of Methodist revivals. She becomes convinced that drinking beer or alcohol of any form is extremely sinful. Jim enjoys his beer. So this makes their relationship even more difficult. The last night of their life, of her life, Nell's life, she is in the dining room with her sister Ollie, with Ollie's suitor Roy Crawford, with her cousin Carrie Cropsey from New York State, and with Jim Wilcox. Now, the discussion that evening is very grim because it's about the best way to commit suicide. How do you prefer to die? Do you want to die by drowning? Do you want to die by poison? It's very grim. Carrie excuses herself and goes to bed because the company is too grim for her. Around 11 o'clock, Jim asks Nell to step outside with him. Now, she's wearing nothing but a sweater and a light slipper, one slipper on one foot because she has a painful corn. She steps onto a frosty November night with him. According to his story, he gives her his photograph or her photograph that she'd given him 3 years earlier, gives her her parasol, and tells her he's breaking up with her. She's never seen again. And now, the people who were in that room that night, Carrie, she goes back to New York. Ollie, the sister, she becomes a recluse. She never again appears in public and never changes her hairstyle, never changes her clothing. Roy Crawford, he shoots himself to death in Texas in 1908. A brother who was in the house but not in the same room with them, Will Cropsey, in 1913, he commits suicide by drinking poison. Very, very strange end to these people. Jim Wilcox himself, he is charged with murder because Nell is not found. She is found 30 days later, floating in the Pasquotank River in a state of perfect preservation. Hardly any discoloration. No creatures have nibbled on her body. Nothing. The coroner and his jury, they club Jim Wilcox. They say that Jim Wilcox should be held until the guilty party can be found, or something to that effect. Well, lynch mobs have formed everywhere. He's in grave danger. The governor places a National Guard around the jail to protect him. His trial is a travesty. The trial, people have the fire engine, the old steam fire engine called Betsy, pulled up and down in front of the courthouse with a bell ringing. They do everything to disrupt the trial. There are women present. The newspaper says, one of the newspapers, there are three newspapers in town at the time, one of the newspapers says, women should never come into a courtroom. What are our ladies? What is wrong with our ladies? Well, we know what's wrong with our ladies. Said, too many Northerners settled here after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Too many Northerners settled here, and they have perverted our ladies. We've got to reclaim our ladies. Anyway, Jim Wilcox is found guilty. He's going to be condemned to death. The Supreme Court says the trial was unfair. He has a second trial in Perkiomen's County. Fortunately, members of that trial, the jury, are Quakers. They do not believe in capital punishment. They sentence him to life in prison. The governor finally pardons him in the year 1918. And he comes back to town. He goes to church one Sunday. People get up and move to the other side. He is a recluse. He is shunned. He is an alcoholic. It's the saddest story in the world. The only thing we know is that he keeps in his Bible a lock of Nell's hair. And finally, in 1934, he blows his brains out. And the very night that he blows his brains out, Ollie Cropsey calls newspaper reporters from the Daily Advance. They come, she and her father, use that night, the night of his death, to club him and insist that he killed Nell. What is their evidence? He was sulky that night. Sulky that last night. He was not pleasant. He was sulky. So he murdered her. Sulky. And he had a blackjack. He owned a blackjack. He definitely killed her. Well, so that's on the basis of this story, I start my research in the eighth grade. And fortunately, there are people alive who have connections to either the Cropseys or the Wilcoxes.
At that time.
At that time, there are still people alive who can help me. There are attorneys who can help me and say this case would never come to fruition in that year, 1953, when I was doing my research. Now, finally, my aunt, who lives next door, Aunt Adelaide, she gives me the crucial information. The crucial information that had come from her father, who was in a position to know, my grandfather. He was in a position to know exactly what happened or what did not happen, and it was not Jim. But I can't say any more because this is the fifth book, and the fifth book has not come out yet, but it's written.
So you're giving us an advance.
I'm giving you an advance.
On a story that we wouldn't be able to read maybe for a year or two.
So
book five. No,
you
actually, book until, in maybe 2 months it'll be out.
So you actually now know who killed her.
I don't know who killed her, but I know who covered it up, and I know who did not kill her. I know that Jim Wilcox did not kill her, and I know who covered it up. But I'd rather wait.
Well, we won't push him.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that is
he would tell. We would push him, but we have to take a break. It's time to take a break. We're going to come back, and we're going to see how this research led on to the whole series of memoirs that William Dunstan is sharing with us today. Lloyd Kramer and William Dunstan, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My co-host is Professor Lloyd Kramer, and our guest is William Dunstan, and we're talking about his writing. Right now, we're getting ready to talk about your memoirs, and I've had a chance to look through the first three volumes. Lloyd, when we were talking, the name Proust sort of jumped up about the memory, the power of memory, and what you can do with memory. Were you thinking of William Dunstan? Were you thinking of Proust when you got started writing your memoirs?
No.
You know what we're talking about.
Yes. But no, what I was thinking about when I started this is I really just wanted to write a series of stories. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about maybe writing a magazine article. But as more and more people ask me to include such and such and such and such, I started to make a list of everything that people wanted to be included, and then I started thinking my own stories that they hadn't asked about. Well, my big concern was who is going to believe these stories? Who's going to believe any of this?
What's the story?
And so I need documentation. So what I did is I started going to the North Carolina collection, the University of North Carolina. I spent years in the North Carolina collection on microfilm, reading the newspapers of the entire period, so that I could find any documentation I could. In fact, the whole Nell Cropsey and Jim Wilcox story that I put together, I did it from the newspaper accounts, News and Observer, newspapers in New Bern, newspapers in Windsor, North Carolina, newspapers in Norfolk, newspapers in Elizabeth City. That's what I used. So what I wanted is I wanted documentation. Any scrap of documentation. I had the love letters my father sent to my mother. So I had those, fortunately. I had my yearbooks when people in those days, they would write wonderful messages in the yearbooks. And the girl who played Ollie Cropsey in my play, she writes in the yearbook, she said, "Remember Ollie Cropsey, dead Nellie's sister." So there is documentation that this play actually took place. There is that documentation. Any scrap of documentation. Some cases I don't have it, but usually I can find some kind of documentation for what I'm saying. Usually. Not always.
Now, William, excuse me for pressing you on this, but what kind of story that is in your book that you thought might be subject to challenge because it's unbelievable and that you had to get some documentation for it? These are just ordinary stories of growing up, aren't they? Are there some that you think are just especially?
Well, they probably are ordinary stories, but in my day, people thought they were extraordinary.
Like, give us
for example. What about bringing the goldfish back to life? They thought that was extraordinary.
Tell us
and that was, one of the magazines we received in the mail was the Four Times. And it was an interesting little magazine, something like the Reader's Digest. And I think the story was in the Four Times, but it could have been in another magazine. But it was about people living in the 19th century, early 19th century, in northern Vermont or northern Maine, and they didn't have any food for the winter. They didn't know how they would get by, so they would take the elderly members of the family— and they would give them a drink until they passed out, and then they would wrap them in straw and put ice and snow around them and put them in a snowbank until warmer weather. And then they would pour warm water on them and give them some more drink and bring them back. Oh. Well, you know, it's a preposterous story, but I mentioned it in my class, and I said, I'd like to do an experiment to see if this is possible by using a creature such as a goldfish to see if I could freeze a goldfish and bring it back.
Mm-hmm. How old are you now at this stage?
Well, I'm 13.
You're 13? Okay, keep going. This is a great story. Keep going.
So anyway, so I bring the fish to class frozen, solid frozen. And my beloved maid had asked me, she said, what are you doing with that goldfish? She said, Billy, what are you doing with that goldfish? She always called me Billy. She said, Billy, what are you doing with that goldfish? She said, I know you didn't bring it at home as a pet. See, she knew me all so well. Her name was Claudia Lee, Chloe. She was a second mother to me. And if anyone reads the books, they'll see how much I love Chloe. So anyway, she said, Billy, what are you doing with that fish? She said, I know that is not a pet. And I said, I'm going to freeze it. She said, that is not a very nice thing to do. I said, but it's a scientific experiment. See, my moral compass was weak at that time. And so into the refrigerator it goes. And the next day it comes with me to school. And there it is, frozen. And so I say to my classmates, now we're going to have to let this thaw a little bit. But anyway, in the meantime, I had brought two 45-volt batteries. And I wire them together for a whopping 90 volts. And so I put a clip on one end of the fish and a clip on the other, and I just send 90 whopping volts through that fish. And boy, oh boy, does that fish leap into the air. And we put the fish into a little tank, and it swims around for, about 30 seconds or so, and then it just stops. So one of my classmates decides that I didn't give it enough electricity. So he takes it out, and he doesn't give it a gentle little 90 volts like I did, a little touch. He gave it about 15 seconds of 90 volts, and I mean the thing started smoking and so forth. But I mean this made a huge impact on my students, and I'm not my students, but my classmates,
my classmates,
and so they would remember these stories for years and years. And here's another good example: seventh grade, three students in the book. They're called Ginger, Abigail, and Kate. That's not their real names.
It's not their real names.
No, it's not their real names. But anyway, they go downtown for lunch.
Again, and these are 13, 14-year-olds?
Yeah, well, they would be 12 at this time, seventh grade. So they come back from lunch, and they've got a pack of Juicy Fruit gum. And so they put the gum in their mouths, and you know you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to chew gum in school, and I beg for peace. And they give me one. They're very generous to me. I'm a good friend of theirs. And so I'm chewing the Juicy Fruit. They're chewing the Juicy Fruit. The teacher, Catherine Winder, whips around from the blackboard. She says, "I smell tutti frutti." "I smell tutti frutti." She said, "Is that you?" Pointing to me. And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And so she says, "Give me the gum and you will stay in after school." The other three, they sit back and join this gum. Well, this becomes known as the Tutti Frutti incident. And people write about it in yearbooks for years. Uh-huh, I mean, uh-huh. Like when I'm a senior, one student says, "Well, old Tutti Frutti, it's the end for us now. We're graduating." I mean, even in the 12th grade, they're still remembering Tutti Frutti. So these stories, they become part of your memory.
And part of your identity.
And part of your identity.
Because the way you narrate these stories, and I know this is part of a Southern small-town life, too.
It
stories
is.
Take on a life of their own, and they get passed from person to person. So what you're doing in these books, in a way, is you're telling stories as if you were sitting on the porch with a bunch of friends and say, "This is what happened. These are the people I knew. These are experiences in Elizabeth City." But what's fascinating to me is the way these stories, although they're about specific people and specific incidents, tell us a lot about the dynamics of small-town life in North Carolina.
They certainly do. And they tell you, there are many other things they tell you too, because I don't neglect what's happening around me. For example, if Sputnik goes up, that's a big event.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we all talk about. We read the newspaper every day, and we talk about what we read in the newspaper. And we talk about, I'll tell you one thing we talked about a lot from the time I was little. Segregation was something we talked about. And I think that in my boyhood, that only three people that I knew opposed segregation. I opposed segregation. My mother did, but quietly, because she told me, she said, if I speak up, she said, I will have no friends. And then, of course, Chloe, our maid, I asked her directly what she thought about it. I wanted to ask her for a long time, but it took me a lot it took me several years before I got the courage to ask her, because I knew it was a very sensitive subject. So I said, "Chloe, I said, I want to talk to you about something that has bothered me for years." And I said, "It's segregation." And I said, "What is your take on this? How do you feel about segregation? Do you support it?" She said, "Well," she said, "let me tell you something." She said, "When I take my little girl in a store and there is a fountain and she will want a Coke or a Pepsi, and I'll say, 'No, honey, we can't stop here.' And then when we go to a water fountain, and she might go to the wrong one because she can't read yet, and I'll have to move her to the other one." And she'll say, "But I want the other fountain." No, this is where you must drink." So I saw the horrors of segregation from the time I was born. To me, they were horrors.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw many other horrors too. And I include these freely in these books because I want the person to feel like they are actually living with me from the time I'm born until I graduate from high school.
Well, I hate to take a break. We're going to have to take a break. Lloyd Kramer, my co-host, and I are visiting with William Dunstan. We're talking about his writing, and in particular his memoir of growing up in Elizabeth City. He and I and Lloyd will be right back.
If it's happening in our Chapel Hill Carborough community, you will hear about it on 97.9 FM, WCHL, and you'll find it on our website, chapelborough.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My co-host, Professor Lloyd Kramer, and I are having a wonderful chat with William Dunstan. We're talking right now about his memoir. The first three volumes are out. The fourth will be out any day, and the fifth is coming up pretty soon. But what Lloyd and I have read about is you're growing up in Elizabeth City, and it's set in some very interesting times historically. We just got a few minutes. Tell us what would you like to share with us about your books and your memories?
Well, I would like to share the love that I had for my teachers. Most of my teachers, almost all of them. The first grade teacher, I repeated the first grade, by the way, because first time. I was ill most of the first year of school, and my father was told by a physician that I could die, and so the only way to save me, there was one possibility, give me a glass of beer every night, and that might save me. He paid me a dime to drink a little glass of beer every night, and at first I hated it, but then I grew to like it, and then it was taken away from me. But the next year, my health was much better, and I had a teacher named Miss Carrie Papendick. She was of German ancestry, and she truly loved her students. I guess she was around in probably 58, 59, or 60 at the time. She truly loved her students, and she shared so many things with us of great value, I believe. For example, at Christmas, she had a Christmas tree brought in. She told us all about the history of the Christmas tree. She told us about Prince Albert and Queen Victoria and their Christmas tree and the custom spreading to the United States. And then she didn't stop there. She brought in these spin shades from Germany, these old spin shades. You'll put them on the top of Christmas lights. Christmas lights at that time were the size of peanuts, and she would point them straight up, and they got hot. And you'd put these little parchment shades on the lights. They had hand-painted scenes on them, and they would spin slowly, and they would propel the classroom in sort of a European orbit. But now, what even amazed me more than those spin shades was she told us about the custom of old Christmas on the Outer Banks. The people on the Outer Banks, when they came to the when they settled on the Outer Banks, they did not accept the new calendar. They were still using the old Julian calendar. They didn't accept the Gregorian calendar because it had been perhaps had been instituted by the Pope, and they weren't fond of him. So anyway, their celebration of Christmas was on January the 5th, which would be Epiphany Eve. And she told us all about these wonderful customs on the Outer Banks, about what they did. Well, they didn't have all the luxuries we had there in Elizabeth City, but they had a mythical animal called Old Buck. And two men would put on this costume to appear as Old Buck, and these two men would give really rough rides on their backs to boys, and they would come with Saint Nicholas, and there were special things. They cooked cakes with raisins. That was a sign of old Christmas, and they also ate. They roasted oysters. That was something that was traditional to eat at old Christmas. And they had this old drum that they said had come over in a colonial period, but no one really knew where it came from. And they would beat this old drum, and they would sing these old Christmas hymns that were not sung in Elizabeth City, real old Christmas hymns from England. Mm-hmm. So she just painted these wonderful pictures of old Christmas. And I have never forgotten some of the things that my teacher said to me. I mean, that's the first grade, and I can remember it just like yesterday.
So could I ask you one final question? Yeah. In the book, I feel that you're very critical of your father and about the relationship that your father and mother had. What do you think your parents' marriage tells us about your father as a human being and about marriage in North Carolina in the mid-20th century?
This is a great question. You've got about 30 seconds to answer it.
Well, my father could not help the way he was. I loved my father, but I tried to stay as far away from him as possible. He had inherited the family curse, which many people inherited, which is mental disability. And he had inherited that. I don't think he could help the way he was, but he made life a living hell for everyone around him.
Well, that's a shame, but I think the way your stories tell it, it shows that he had personal issues, but he was also limited by the world in which he lived. He could never get beyond that mentality. So it's a very interesting narrative of what it's like to be a young white boy in a southern town in the 1940s. and thank you very much for writing it.
And thank you for sharing it with us. William Dunstan, before we sign off, where can people who'd like to read or buy this book, what's the way to get a hold of the book?
Well, this gives me an opportunity to mention Stacy Smith at the Bull's Head Bookshop. She is a wonderful manager of the bookshop, and she'll be delighted to order books for you. If she doesn't have them in stock, she has some. You can also order them online through Amazon, and they're on sale through Amazon right now.
Great. Well, listen, thanks, William Dunstan. Thanks, Lloyd Kramer, for being my co-host. What a treat for me to be with the two of you. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.